October the 12th, 1977. My name is James Murphy, and I'm talking with Major General Kitching. And today we're going to discuss the General Kitching's experience as General Staff Officer 1 of the Chief Staff of the 1st Canadian Corps in Italy, which to which you moved to in November of 1944.
November 1944, right.
This, after the training, when the training brigade was, how long were you with that? Was it that
five? The training brigade?
Yeah.
Only about 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
And it continued then under somebody else for about the same period and then was disbanded.
Were you surprised at being in command of that for such a short time?
Oh, no. I think it was a stopgap. I think maybe the authorities felt that I knew what was wanted at the sharp end, and they also knew that I wanted a fairly interesting assignment, you know, something that had some life in it, and that I was not a desk person. I think that for that reason, maybe I went there, and then from there, in early November, I was notified, in October. But I was going out to 1st Canadian Corps as Chief of Staff, and I was delighted. It was, to me, I'd known it as a theatre before. So, a fairly short notice, I packed up and headed for an aircraft, and we waited 3 or 4 days. In those days, this was not unusual. And finally, an aircraft was heading for Italy, so I piled aboard it, and fortunately, by this time, the Germans had been cleared of all of France, so that we were able to fly over the Loire, although it was night, I remember, or early dawn when we were crossing over the Loire, but we then hit Rome around 10 or 11 in the morning, and I was delighted when General Burns, who was commanding the 1st Canadian Corps, of which I was going to be Chief of Staff, I had a message from him to say that I was to meet him for lunch and spend the afternoon with him, after which I would then go up to First Corps itself. Now, General Burns was on leave from First Corps in Rome. So I had lunch with him, and afterwards he and I went for a walk in the Borghese Gardens, which are very famous gardens in Rome, a very old park, public park now, originally belonging to the Borghese family. And during the time I was with Tommy Burns, about 2 hours, he told me about operations in Italy since the time I'd left in late February, early March of the same year, 44. And he told me about the Liri Valley, the campaign leading up to the clearing of the whole of the western part of Italy, and up to the capture of Florence, which was done by Canadian forces. And then the subsequent battles up to, not too far, to Rimini, which was then our headquarters. Tommy Burns told me all this, and he, about 4 or 5 in the evening, after lunch, I got in a station wagon, which had been placed at my disposal, and I just took off. And you know, it's a long drive from Rome to Ravenna. You're going right through the spine of Italy in wartime. However, the driver seemed to know where the hell he was going, so we took off, and we went for about 6 hours, and about 10 or 11 o'clock, we came across a small Canadian arranged hotel, and I went in, we slept the night and got up about 5 and started off again. And I finally got to the headquarters near Rimini, which is up on the northeast coast, just south of Venice. And I remember I went in, it was about 7, I guess, when we got in there, 7 or 8 in the morning, so we must have driven for many hours. I said we got up at 4, maybe we got up at 3 in order to get up there quickly. And I went up to the room that was apportioned to me in a building that was the Corps headquarters, and I shaved and went down to about 7 or 8 to get some breakfast, 8 o'clock. And I remember Desmond Smith, who was the man that I was to take over from, was sitting at breakfast. And I said to Des, he was a brigadier, I saw the Corps commander yesterday, and he sent his regards. And I always remember he said to me, "Which one?" Well, you know, you could have floored me with a feather. And I said, "What the hell do you mean?" And he said, who did you see?" So I said, "Tommy Burns." And he said, "Well, I don't think he's going to be Corps commander any longer." Now, this is my first...
contact with...
I had no idea. Burns had told me he'd be coming up in 3 or 4 days and so on. But in fact, Burns did not reappear, and there was obviously a tremendous friction between some Canadian officers, including Smith, and Burns. Chris Vokes was the acting Corps commander. He had commanded 1st Canadian Division after Simmons left, and was a highly respected and a damn good Canadian soldier, well known, and I think the men liked it. And he'd done extremely well. Well, you know, this is a queer environment to walk into when you find a measure of disloyalty to that extent. Not with Chris Vokes. Chris was a loyal fellow. He'd be loyal to Satan if he had to be. But here were staff officers who were joking, saying, "Which one?" in a way that I didn't particularly appreciate. And subsequently, Vokes went on. We went into operations, and Vokes continued to command the Corps. In fact, he received a signal from General Alexander, who was then the commander of all forces in the Mediterranean, taken over from Eisenhower. And Alex sent him a message saying, "Congratulations, I understand you're going to command 1st Canadian Corps. Well deserved. You're well known, and we have great confidence." Well, Chris, I think, assumed that Alex had some knowledge that Chris was about to be promoted. And it was a very bitter blow. In fact, that night, I went with Chris Vokes to a dinner, really almost to celebrate his coming elevation, and also the elevation of Des Smith, who had been my predecessor, who Smith thought, he was going to get command of 1st Division after Vokes. So you get two people who thought they were going to be promoted, and it was supposed to be, and it was a very nice party. Well, 2 or 3 days afterwards, I went off somewhere to look at something, and on my way back, when I got back to Corps headquarters, there was a signal, top secret, eyes only, which meant either the commander or the chief of staff, more or less. So I opened it, and it said that General Vokes was to return to Northwest Europe to take over 4th Canadian Armored Division, which had been my division 4 months previously, and that General Charles Fuchs had been promoted to command 1st Canadian Corps. Well, this was a very, very bitter blow to Chris Vokes. First of all, Charles Fuchs was junior to him. He was certainly not as well experienced as a soldier as Chris. Chris had commanded a brigade in Sicily. He commanded the 1st Division extremely well. And he had established a great reputation. He was known as the warlord, literally. He was possessive, he was arrogant, he was proud. But being of Irish extraction, he had a heart about as big as Brooklyn, New York, and all the rest of them. And so this compensated for any brusqueness that Chris might have shown in his public image. But his inner heart was tremendously soft and a decent man. Well, Chris was... I had the awful job of handing him this signal. And he came into his caravan. I was standing at the door of it, and he said, "Well, George, what, you know, what the hell is happening?" And I said, "Well, there's a signal here for you." And I waited till he got in, and I gave it to him, and then I more or less left it. And of course, Chris was deeply hurt. He was not hurt at going back to going to Fort Ahmed. This didn't concern him. It was the fact that he was being removed from a theater of which he had great knowledge. The people like Alexander, people like Dick McCreary, who was commanding the army at that time, and Oliver Leese before him, that's 8th Army, and Monty, had had great confidence in Chris. And obviously, the Canadians did not. And this is what hurt Chris, that for some reason, he was being removed by a Canadian orders, and not British, because I think the Brits would have, and the Americans, of course, thought very highly of him, too. Anyway, so the day, and Harry Foster, who had commanded 4th Armoured Div, took over from me in Normandy, was to come out and command 1st Canadian Division. So you get two people from Northwest Europe coming in. Well, Foster everybody knew, and they had great confidence. He'd done very well with 7th Brigade in the Normandy landing. He'd done well with 4th Armoured Div, so there was no problem there. But Charles Foulkes, his promotion over Chris hurt the whole First Corps. I remember everybody from Lieutenant Colonel up I knew said, who is this son of a bitch who is coming in? Who the hell's Foulkes? Why do they put him in here when you've got a perfectly good guy who would have taken over? Well, of course, I had no idea. Anyway, and the terrible thing was that when the final day came, about a week afterwards, Charles Foulkes was due to arrive. Now, Charles was, he flew out, arrived, I guess, in Rome, or wherever the hell it was. He then went to Alexander's headquarters, Caserta, north of Rome, south of Rome, and I suppose made his number, said who he was, and so on. Then they gave him a Mitchell bomber to fly up in from wherever the hell he was up to Ravenna, to Rimini. And unfortunately, in the way rather slap-happy bomber crews operate, to them the difference between Rimini, where we expected him to arrive, and some rather remote airfield not too far away, was just immaterial. I mean, it didn't matter, they dumped the general there, and there'd obviously be somebody there to meet him, and so on. Meanwhile, Chris Foulkes had done his level best to Charles Foulkes. He had arranged a band, a guard of honor. There was a red carpet. There was every goddamn thing that you could imagine to greet the new corps commander. Chris didn't agree with this, but he'd done it because it was his responsibility and his duty. So there we were, all lined up at Airport A to receive Charles Foulkes, who didn't arrive. And we waited an hour. And finally, we got an urgent message from 8th Army headquarters to say Foulkes had arrived there in a jeep. Where the hell were we? So Chris Foulkes and I went to 8th Army headquarters. And there was Foulkes, mad as hell. And apparently what had happened, Charles had been dumped by this American bomber crew, Mitchell bomber crew, on an airfield where nobody knew him. It was a fairly small airfield, one of many, many airfields from which Allied aircraft were operating. And alongside it was a Canadian workshop of the electrical and mechanical engineers. So Charles Foulkes, who was not a particularly imposing person, you know, to look at. Chris Foulkes was imposing because of his size and his handlebar mustaches and his rather glowering expression. Everybody knew him. Charles Foulkes went into this little Remy workshop and said, because he was angry, there was nobody there to meet him, and he assumed that this was complete disloyalty on our part. Mm-hmm. He assumed this immediately. So he went in, and there was a corporal or somebody in the Remy standing not too far off, and Charles called out, said, "I'd like to take a jeep, please. I'm General Foulkes." And the soldier said, "Oh, no, you're not. We know General Foulkes. We know him goddamn well. You're not him." Well, the similarity of the names was unfortunate.
Right, yeah.
Even a captain, I think, who commanded the small workshop, said to folks, you know, you're crazy. I'm sorry. We know General Folkson. Charles was getting a little irritated by this time. There he was, standing with a briefcase in his hand and a duffel bag of clothing or whatever the hell he had. I've forgotten. Finally, he stopped a provost, a corporal, who again said, we think you're a spy, or words to that effect. But anyway, the provost fellow said, all right. So Charles almost commandeered, under almost had to say to the fellow, I'll put you under close arrest if you don't do it. He then drove straight to 8th Army headquarters, where he arrived in a towering rage, went in to see Dick McCreary, General Dick McCreary, who was the commander of 8th Army, and told McCreary that obviously Vokes, Chris Vokes, and Kitching had organized a sort of a sit-down strike, etc., etc. Well, shortly afterwards, we turned up, and I got in the car, and I sat in the front seat beside the driver, and Chris and Charles Vokes sat in the back, and the conversation, as you can imagine, was pretty goddamn dull. It didn't sparkle at all. And when we got to the other end, Chris said, George, to me, you show the corps commander where he lives and tell him all about what's happening. He turned to Charles and said, well, goodbye. That's the handover. So when we got, then walked with Charles Vokes into the caravan, which the corps commander normally had. These were big trailers, really, and built onto trucks. And there were a bedroom, come office, come everything. And Charles asked me to go in, and he said, don't forget, Jim, that 4 months previously, he and I had been divisional commanders together.
Right.
He was the one who, at that time, said that he was going to be fired first. So I was fired instead. And so here he is, he turns up, and I don't know why, but he assumed that everything was against him from our point of view. So I remember he got in this caravan, he walked about 2 paces, which is about all he could walk in it, and then turned to me and said, George, what's going on? So I said, look, for Christ's sake, sir, first time I had to call him sir, you arrived at the wrong airport. Had you gone to the right one, you would have had the best reception in the world. You would have had Chris Vokes greeting you properly. Everybody there with a band and a guard of honor, you would have been received in the way you should have been. But your crew dumped you in the wrong place, and we had no idea. They never notified the airfield we were in that they dumped you even. So eventually this placated him. And I said, I think the best thing now is I've got all the staff of the Corps, who are all senior brigadiers. Some have been cabinet ministers, you know, and they're now soldiers and so on. I said, they're now in a room in the building that we used as a headquarters. And I think the best thing is you just come and say hello to them and make your number, which he did, and did it very well. But that was a disastrous entry, as you can imagine, yes, from his point of view, and a hell of an entry for me, because as I discovered after the war, the first thing he did on arrival was to say that he needed a new chief of staff, because he assumed I was amongst the rebels. However, that part didn't matter much. But it was a... So there was a difficult period on entry of about a month by the time Burns was fired and Folks arrived and we get settled down again. However, he did bring... Folks brought with him from his experiences in Belgium and Holland a knowledge of the use of buffaloes, as we call them. They were really armored personnel carriers that swam. Mm-hmm. The ones we had in Normandy didn't swim. These were swimming, which had made a tremendous difference in Northwest, in Holland and Belgium. And Charles Vokes had some knowledge of these, which nobody else had. So he had an idea of their use, which subsequently proved, after we'd gone, we did all the planning, but subsequently the other divisions that took over from us in Italy used our know-how and our planning and did extremely well. But the problem really was 1st and 5th Divisions in 1st Canadian and 5th Armoured Canadian was they were very, very spaghetti league, as we call them. So was I. You were very proud to be part of a group that had fought so well and done so well. We call them spaghetti league. Some of the people call them mafia because we were so strong and powerful and so on. But the both divisions and the 1st Armored Brigade, with three superb regiments in the armored regiments, were heavily Spaghetti League, very proud of being 8th Army and being Italian-Sicilian. And you can see it all the way through. The operations that we became involved in from November, December, January, were essentially trying to reach this a river called the Senio to outflank the German forces that were holding the Americans at near Bologna. And we did a series of battles, of attacks and battles, and they were pretty fierce too, across canals and rivers, which within a period of 3 hours of a rainstorm in the mountains, 10 miles away, could go from a trickle of water, almost like a bathtub emptying, into a roaring torrent 40 feet across and 15, 20 feet deep. The canals were built above the level of the land. And over the centuries, they had been used really to irrigate the many, many vineyards and farms that lay on the right and left. They would make a small break in these huge walls and bleed off so much water to feed a field and then close the aperture. And the danger, of course, in which the Germans obviously threatened to do the whole time, was to blow one of the dikes, which would then flood, really, well, as they did in Holland, many thousands of very rich producing acres. Well, they never quite blew the dike to the extent of destroying them completely, but there was always the prospect of this. So when you attacked, you had to attack across a canal, so-called, or a river, which could rise and fall, literally, overnight from 0 to 15, 20 feet of roaring flood, so that you couldn't ever count on it as being able to walk across it. They were fairly hectic days, and there were some tremendous battles fought by our fellows with the Boche, many of them at very, very close quarters, 15, 10 feet apart, in the same bank, as it were, on the same side of the river, with one side on one piece and one on the other shoulder of the bank. Not unlike some of the periods of World War I, when they literally owned almost each side of a trench. So it was a pretty hectic period. It was cold, it was miserable as hell, and it was wet. And I think when we finally got the order, if I remember, in early February, Charles Foulkes got me in and said, "We're going to Northwest Europe." And he and I then went to, and Gilbride, who was the brigadier in charge of administration at the headquarters, we sat down and discussed the problems we would have. And of course, it was the first time I realized, not quite the first time, but that there was a tremendous machine for the deception of the enemy had been created by the British, primarily by the British. So that any movement of large bodies of troops was denied, the knowledge of it was denied to the German by a form of wireless duplication, using the same operators that we had been using, the Canadians who had been using sets in a battle and so on, remained and were headed to the hills just behind us, and remained in constant contact. The Germans were very clever at wireless interception, at what came to be known as Y service. In other words, a German operator could read a Canadian unit's, the information they were handing out. He wouldn't really know what they were saying, but he knew by the voice of the individual, he knew if it was in key, which is rarely, that the key operator, he knew exactly the sort of finesse of the key. He knew every turn there was, so you couldn't fool him by putting phony operators onto the same sets. You had to almost leave the same fellow. So a great many Canadian operators just pulled out into the hills behind us, continued to talk, whilst the whole Canadian, 1st Canadian Corps, upsticked. We moved about and the extraordinary, it was really, it was an operation called Gold Flake. And I remember as Chief of Staff, I issued one piece of paper on, and I suppose it had about five paragraphs only on it. And it was to say the 1st Canadian Corps would move to Northwest Europe. It was top secret, of course. That it would do so by going from its present location to Leghorn, Lugano, on the west coast of Italy, and from there take ship to Marseille, and from there be directed by Allied forces. And this five or six paragraphs was the only order issued in writing. By this time, 1st Canadian Corps operated by mouth, by word of mouth. The confidence of each other, in each other, was, I think, one of the most remarkable things about 8th Army. 8th Army had taught us this. And you never issued paper unless you could possibly avoid it. Paper was a thing that could be captured, could be taken, could be lost, could be duplicated. But the word couldn't. And I was reminded by the officer Bob Hilborn, who was the president of one of the big insurance companies now in Toronto, was reminded by Bob about 4 or 5 years ago that I turned to him and at the end of the meeting and said, "Bob, fix it." You know, he was then a major. And so Bob Hilborn and some fellows on the staff of Gilbride sit down and they cook up the move of about 60,000 Canadian soldiers, 20,000 vehicles, 500 tanks, 700 tanks, to move in a period of about 7 or 8 days out of action when you're in contact with the enemy, back, and then move almost by one road across the whole of the spine of Italy, running all alongside the enemy the whole way, 10 miles, 15, 20 miles from them, but running right across the spine, getting to Leghorn in the right time, in the right order, to get onto the ships, to be then taken to Marseille, and then directed from Marseille up to North Holland. And this whole move, Gold Flake, the Germans never knew about it. They still considered, in the battle maps that were captured after the war, that the 1st Canadian Corps was in Italy. It was really, Jim, one of the most remarkable moves, I think, for security that have ever been made. Everybody had to take down his Canadian identity. There were no flashes, no regimental badges allowed. Mm. All vehicles were shrouded out from the point of view of identification. So any Italian, seeing a stream of soldiers, wouldn't know whether we were British or I suppose, what, there were 9 nationalities, I think, in 8th Army at that time. We could have been any. And as I say, it was remarkable. We arrived in North Holland and the enemy had absolutely no knowledge of our entry into North Holland until we attacked near Arnhem. So it was a remarkable achievement. And could only have been done, in my opinion, because of the confidence that units had in the commanders and commanders in the senior staffs. And it doesn't happen that way very often. This had been built up over a period of 2 years of very intimate knowledge and very close liaison.
How large, before we get to Arnhem, how large would the staff be of a corps?
Let's see. Corps headquarters, I guess, at that time, we were far too fat. By nuclear standards, by atomic standards, we were much too fat. We were too big. I think had the Germans had a powerful air force, we would have shrunk in size very considerably. Because, of course, the bigger the size of the headquarters, the more easy it is to find.
Right.
I would think at that time we had a total of about, if I remember, say 140 vehicles of all kinds. That's to do with intelligence, to do with operations, to do with administration, with personnel, with provo, with just about everything, the control system. About 140 vehicles, maybe 400 people. But since the enemy didn't have a powerful headquarters, we generally remained as one entity, generally. Had he had a powerful headquarters, we would have split into probably 4 or 5 parts, and we would have had a very small headquarters with folks himself. And then the others would be scattered according to the requirement. But it was about that size then, about 400 to 500 people, about 120 vehicles.
how the rank structure go?
Well, the of course the corps commander was a 3-star general, a lieutenant general, and then I was chief of staff as a brigadier. The chief of administration was a brigadier. The chief of engineers, the chief of artillery, the chief of signals were all brigadiers. Yes, they were the main component. We were all young, all very young, you know. By modern standards, we were all very young.
So the corps had a artillery staff officer?
Oh, yes,
or
yes. He was the commander of all the artillery in the corps.
He was the commander.
He was known as CCRA, Commander, right. Corps Artillery.
And he was attached to the staff as well?
Oh, yes. He, really, when the corps commander said, this is what I'm going to do, having discussed the possibilities with the gunner, and or the artilleryman, the engineer, everybody else, having heard their different points of view, if there was a requirement to do so, he would then say, well, this is what I'm going to do. And then he would say to the chief gunner, I want such and such a division's artillery to support the other division during this period of their attack. In other words, the direction or the directing of the artillery resources of all kinds would be by the corps artilleryman. Now, if it was only a divisional battle, in other words, one of the divisions under corps, then the corps artilleryman would go down to the division and say, how can I help? What can I do to help you? And if they didn't have enough artillery, he'd produce it from somewhere else. This was the purpose, really. It was to if you had a coordinator, really, more than a commander, is really his job. But it was to go down and see that whoever was going to do the punch had everything behind him that we could possibly give him. And his job, of course, was to see that the corps commander's plan was carried out, just as my job was as chief of staff, to make sure that when the corps commander said, I want this, that, and the other to happen, it was my job as a staff officer to make sure that the thing progressed according to his plan. If it didn't, or if it appeared to be going awry, it was my job to get in touch with him very quickly, and if I couldn't find him, the man who was responsible for making it go awry, to try and correct it. There's a very, and I think that's one of the most important things that came out of the war, that we all had a responsibility. It wasn't just the guy fighting, you know, the sharp end. Everybody was pulling for him. Everybody was putting everything they could to help him, including not just encouragement, that they were watching to make goddamn sure that he did what was required, because if he didn't, very often this could affect, you know, his right and his left, or mm-hmm. future plans, or whatever it might be. But it was an orchestra.
How far were you from the front usually?
Corps headquarters?
In terms of, not so much, in terms of time and that sort of thing.
Communication. Well, in that part in Italy, where you are divided by canals and bridges, and you don't, when you are divided by rivers and canals, which only have a limited number of bridges, which are under fire the whole time, you obviously don't pile as much as you can forward, because all you do is present more and more targets to the enemy, more and more river crossings to be made, or bridge crossings by the people at the front end. I would say that, I have a map somewhere of that area. I think corps would be about, 5 miles from the sharp end. I would think it wasn't very far. I remember at one time, because the chief doctor and I, the chief doctor was a brigadier, I should have mentioned that too. We went to try and visit a unit at night, and he was driving a jeep, and we went over the front, over the sharp end of our line, and we heard a yell from behind us, and we turned. At that time, it was probably only 3 miles, I don't know, 3,000 yards, not a hell of a lot. But don't forget, the enemy was weak, and he really couldn't take a run at us. Now, New Zealand Corps, which is commanded by General Freyberg in New Zealand over the Victoria Cross, Freyberg had a different view. He said, if Corps headquarters, he had really a division, it wasn't a corps, it was just a division, that he put his headquarters right up within 100 yards of the war. When they were fighting in a small town, I've forgotten the name of it, but I know I went to see him, and the only way you could get to him was to go literally across a square that was bullets flying all directions. And he said he did that because it was the safest place to be. And nobody ever bugged him from the back end. The army commander never came to see him because it was far too dangerous. And anyway, as he said, it encouraged the soldiers. I'm not too sure, quite frankly, that Freiburg was right now. I think if you're supposed to be commanding a battle that extends over 25 miles, in my opinion, you cannot do it 100 yards from the enemy on one point in that 25 miles. In his case, he was capturing or trying to capture a town. Fiori, I think, was the name. And so that's all right. His division only had this small thing to capture. But I think when you're on, as we had, 25, 30, 40 miles of front, with three or four divisions up, there's no point in fiddling around and saying you're going to go right and live with the forward platoon, because, first of all, you're not controlling the people on the right and left. You can't really see what the hell's happening.
Right.
You can't visit them easily without bringing an unnecessary amount of fire down on the wretched people that you're billeted with. So I think you're just being foolish, in my opinion, when you do that. You've got to be able to control, and I think generally Canadian headquarters were about as well placed to control as you could find anywhere.
Moving ahead to Arnhem, were you involved in the Operation Market Garden? That was before.
Market Garden was in September 1944. No, I wasn't.
Oh.
All I saw of Market Garden, I was then the 13th Brigade in Yorkshire, and I remember seeing the swarms of aircraft and gliders and everything else taking off on the Sunday morning of Arnhem, literally hundreds in the air above you. No, but when 1st Canadian Corps, after Gulflick, when we moved from Italy up to northwest Europe, our first task was to capture Arnhem. We moved up there and got in position, I think, by about the middle of March, from about the middle of February to the middle of March, if I recall. It took about that time to get everybody on the move, get them by boat, and then redeployed up north. And the first job we had given to us was to attack and capture Arnhem, which I think we took on early in April, if I remember. That was, of course, an unbelievable experience, because the Dutch people had suffered tremendously for a period of about 8 months under the German rule. In the first 2 years of the war, the Dutch had suffered, but they hadn't suffered that greatly. They were still given food. They were still not so supervised that they couldn't help a great many Allied airmen and others to escape, which they did. And the Dutch underground had time to build up a corps of first-class operators who helped the Allies. It was after the initial Arnhem, after the airborne landing, that period from there, September to April, when we went in, that was really the cruelest part of German occupation of Holland, when they gave the Dutch no food, when they deported thousands of Dutchmen. They had deported Jews before, but they stepped up that reprisal, and then they started tremendous reprisals against all Dutch families connected with the resistance. And I've met many, many families in Holland after we got in there, and I've seen them since. And the Dutch resistance were put up a tremendous fight at that time against the Germans, but they were treated. And the Dutch population were treated shockingly by the Boche at that time. They, as you know, you probably heard, they took to eating the roots of tulips and daffodils, and many people died because they're not for human consumption, many of these things. Many people died from it. When we first got into Holland, when the thing was over, I remember I went to have a look at the damage in Amsterdam, and I went in a jeep with a friend of mine, and who was a Sparling, who was the head artilleryman in the corps. Sparling and I took some sandwiches with us, and the idea being to so that we could spend 3 or 4 hours viewing the wreckage and so on, and then instead of having to hurry, and you couldn't get anything to eat in Holland except in a military environment. So we went off, and by God, we stopped on the edge of Amsterdam, and we no sooner opened the package of these sandwiches, they were wrapped up in some old dirty old piece of paper that somebody had found, then a swarm of kids came around. They had never seen food, you know, little boys of 5, 6, 12, and so on. And, well, we didn't eat anything. You can't, you know. But then it's almost like feeding an animal in a zoo, because the kids, they'd almost eat each other in order to get at it. It was a dreadful sight. I never did it again. I just felt so ashamed of being so fat and well-fed. Not that I was fat, but these kids were in very bad shape. Many of them were dying. And they would have died had they not had we not gone in there. But if I can just go back, the capture of Arnhem was to be the 1st Canadian Corps' new attack. And we were given a British division, 40 knights, to operate under us. And as often happened in World War II, it happened in Normandy when 1st British Corps was put under General Crerar. The British generals, I don't know why, well, I do know why, because I was in the British Army for a while, they seemed to have some doubts about the ability of Canadian generals to tell them what to do. And this is brought out, I think, in Charles Stacey's book about when General Crerar took over and had 1st British Corps under him in Normandy, and how the British Corps commander, General Crocker, almost refused to obey his order. We had a little bit of problem with 49th Div, not too bad, but it was all right, it ironed out. And 49th Div had the job, finally, of capturing Arnhem. 1st and 5th Divisions, our own, swung right and kept, were really the punch behind the invasion of North Holland. The 49th British Division was to capture Arnhem,
right.
Period. And our own 1st Canadian Division and the 5th Armoured Division was to swing north and then swing west and go right around Arnhem and in right to Amsterdam, The Hague, and so on. This was the plan. And fortunately at that time we had with us, who joined us, is Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who headed the Dutch forces, the Netherlands forces, and not just forces of the interior, as they were called, they were the partisans. And he had a very good contact, of course, he and his staff, with all the people in North Holland, and he and his group were of great use to us in dealing with the Dutch people inside the German lines, as it were, and getting information about the disposition of the German forces. They were very useful. The Canadian, I think the Canadian Corps' presence in North Holland, quite frankly, did more to cement relations between the Dutch and the Canadian people than anything since Christ. We were only there a period of 3 to 4 months, but during that period, admittedly, it was a period of liberation. A lady told me the other night here in Victoria, she is of Dutch birth, she was a kid of 15, and she said, when suddenly, around the corner, came Canadian tanks, great big tanks to the Dutch, because they'd only seen really nothing at all, big tanks with inside them even bigger people, and she said, everybody looked so happy, and they all waved, and she told me that she'll never forget, she just burst into tears. As a kid of 15, she'd never seen a man who had the courage to stand up, because, of course, everybody in Holland that she'd known had been carted off. Men were taken off by the thousands. And if you had anything to hide, you hid it. In other words, you couldn't expose it. You couldn't be a man, as it were. And so she said, suddenly, as a kid of 15, to see these large tanks come in with crews that were so full of health and young and happy, and everybody waving like her, she just burst into tears, and she said, it's something she'll never, never forget. This is a girl who's now a Victorian. Mm. And That liberation of Holland was really, in my opinion, put Canada in Europe over the notch. I think we'd always been considered pretty damn good because of World War II, but I think the liberation of Holland, the behavior of the soldiers, the excellent administration that we put into Holland, I think has been acknowledged by the Dutch government and by the Queen and Prince Bernhard as being one of the stabilizing factors in their recovery. And I think that really was a tremendous Canadian contribution to Holland. Mind you, there had been problems, Jim, on the way in. The Germans were by no means beaten. They were quite prepared and did put up tremendous fights, not only against 49th British Division when they were trying to capture Arnhem, but also particularly against 1st Canadian Division and against 5th Armoured Division in their big sort of pull out and swing. 1st Canadian Division had some tremendous experiences in trying to cross into the cities north of Arnhem, the names of which frankly escape me for a second, but I'll remember them. But I remember in one community, I think the 2nd Canadian Brigade of 1st Division, who fought against 1st Parachute Division in one paradiv in Italy on several occasions, were taking on, I think it was in a little town called Zutphen, were taking on, or Appledorn, taking on a German garrison, really, of a very ancient feudal castle, medieval castle, with walls about 15 feet thick and so on. And this was going to take a hell of a lot of subjugating. When the German commander suddenly came out to the white flag, he was a young parachute commander, and they were damn tough, one paradigm. Came out and said, did he see a red flash on somebody's arm? Yes, are you 1st Canadian Division? Yes. Well, in that case, I surrender to you because I fought against you at Ortona. And it was interesting because one paradigm fought against us and they were tough as hell in Ortona. And the 1st Canadian Division had fought against them and beaten them there twice. So.